long did it take before you got your first graduate student?
I got my first graduate student who is Bill Castor, and I think it was 2 or 3 years, maybe 2 years. Let's see what it says here. I got here at 46, and usually they write a little something about themselves. College attended Northwestern. Okay. It says here he arrived in 46 and left in 50. So I probably got him a year after I was here. He was my very first graduate student. And he probably started doing his research in 47. Yeah.
Did he have your course? Is that how you were getting yourself introduced?
Well, yeah, sure. That's exactly right. That's yeah. And he did some zirconium chemistry, because at that time I had just come from Roman Haas, and I'd been doing this zirconium work, and there were a couple of things that I thought might be interest to him, and I was doing myself the kinetics and mechanism of some of the, you know, I was in the lab with my own two hands, my first 2 or 3 papers at least.
Yes.
Single author.
Yes, because you had your first one 1948.
Okay.
Which was even before your PhD thesis was published.
I think that's right, yeah. Because it took a little while to get all this stuff that I'd done with Betty Rapp and Baylor.
And then the other one was in 50. So at that point, were you still looking, in addition to the zirconium work, you were still looking at synthetic work, but your interests were more in mechanisms.
That was right at the beginning of when I was getting into doing solution kinetics and mechanisms, and getting Ralph to come on board.
I was going to ask you
Ralph to come on board and so forth.
How you seduced him.
Well, simply this way. In those days, the department had hired about a half a dozen of us coming in as beginning instructors. About three or four of us survived. The rest didn't survive and went elsewhere. But when we arrived, some of us started having lunch together. And I guess it was Carol King. He was an organic chemist in his office. And the office of this size or even smaller, when you get 3 or 4 people in there, it's pretty full. But we would bring our lunch, and we'd sit and we'd talk about whatever topic happened to come up. It didn't necessarily have to be chemistry. It could be football or basketball, or it could be anything, baseball, the Cubs, or what have you. But chemistry, of course, was always, or oftentimes, a topic of conversation as well. And on those occasions, day in and day out, we would, if we came in with something that was puzzling us or something we were thinking about in terms of our research about to do or something, we might bring that up and talk about it. So little by little, after trying to convince Ralph and his listening to me and telling him what was happening, he finally came around to deciding that yes, this is there are things here that can be done, and this is what we should do, and this is how we should do it in terms of the kinetics and the mechanism. And I could always come up with the complexes that should be used. We should use this for the following reason. We should use that. And I, in those days, could still go in the lab and actually make these compounds. You know, in fact, even when Harry Gray was here, who was probably our most notorious graduate, Harry was busy working with me and Ralph, and he was doing solution kinetics and mechanisms, some platinum compounds that I had actually made, I knew how to make. And I told Harry how to do it, you know, and gave him the recipes and so forth. And you know, the first time, first, second time you try to do something, you don't get the yields that the person who had done it several times. And so Harry would get discouraged, and finally I said, okay, well, just let me make them, you can just run the kinetics. Come in! Charles!
This is the guy I want to see.
Well, there he is.
Good morning. Here's what...
So it was a slow process before Ralph really got totally into it, and he always maintained a certain interest separate from this. But this began to take up the bulk of his time, and in fact, not only that, but he finally, to the outside community, chemistry community, he became recognized as a physical inorganic chemist, and his award, ACS award, is in inorganic chemistry. It's not in physical chemistry and so forth. So that, he really did make a complete big change.
As I said, my recognition of him as a student was, of course, Frost and Pearson.
That sure, the kinetics and mechanisms.
And, never at that point would have thought about his association with inorganic.
Sure,
chemistry.
Sure.
When you started doing this work, this was pretty new in terms of the rest of the world, was there any? Ingold, I want to talk about that if you would like, but I know there's some disagreement there with Ingold's work.
Well, okay.
Did that occur early on?
Yes, and fortunately it turned out to be quite a turning point as far as Ralph and I were both concerned, because Ralph and I were just beginning investigators, you know, in this area of physical inorganic. Well, Ingold also in physical inorganic was just beginning. That's why things happened the way they did. I mean, he was really one of the very best people as far as physical organic chemistry was concerned. But Ron Nyholm, who later became knighted, Sir Ronald Nyholm, Sir Christopher Ingold, and so forth, joined the department there at University College London and started talking to Ingold about his metal complexes, and showed Ingold some of our initial papers, particularly the base hydrolysis reaction is where this all happened. And the reaction that takes place with cobalt amines is first order in the cobalt complex and first order in hydroxide ion. However, hydroxide ion seems to be specific, the specific base that carries out. Now, there are other nucleophiles that you might use, the compound doesn't respond this way. So Ralph and I came up with a acid-base pre-equilibrium type mechanism and conjugate base then undergoing reaction and so forth, which all fit with the second order kinetics. It was consistent with that, and it made more sense to us, and that's what we published. Well, when Ingold when this was pointed out to Ingold, I guess, by Nyholm and the people at University College London, he looked at it, he thought, gee, those two guys, they don't know what they're doing, and this is just an ordinary second order displacement type reaction, just as we have with alkyl halides and hydroxide. And so it came out very loud and clear and strong on this. And it took some doing, you know. You can, as I've always told students, it's impossible to prove a mechanism is right. That's because mechanism is just like any other theory. It's a theory, and it just is not possible to prove it's right. But it is possible to prove that the mechanism is wrong. So then it was up to us to do what needed to be done to try to prove that the mechanism that Ingold had proposed is not correct, which we were able to do, fortunately, because if it had turned out the other way around, you probably never would have heard of Basola and Pearson, and our Northwestern would never have become famous in inorganic chemistry. But it was kind of amusing, because all of this was happening in the late 40s and early 50s, when I had gone on a couple of ACS lecture tours, and I remember going out to the Pacific Northwest and on lecture tours, and yet people would come to my lectures, and I would be all excited about what we were doing. And at the end of it all, somebody would ask her, "What is a chelate, you know? What is a ligand?" and it really, really was a little depressing. But then, about 6 months or so, 6 or 8 months later, I went on a similar lecture tour. I guess this time I was out east someplace. And the attendance was better, and I could see that there were organic chemists there, you know, in addition to inorganic chemists who might come along anyway. But the organic chemists were there because they had read Engel's paper, and they wanted to find out what the hell was going on and what Pearson and I were up to, and why Engel was even bothering to take time of day to pay attention to us. And so they would come, and it was an entirely different audience, because they were physical organic chemists who were able to ask the questions that needed to be asked, you know, and so forth. And as it turned out, of course, we were able eventually to show that the mechanism that Engel proposed was not correct. And so that went a long way in terms of helping both Ralph and myself.
How did Engel react to that, you know?
Like an English gentleman that he is. I mean, I remember back in 61, 62, and this was still, it was almost over by then, but it was still going on. I was a guest of his department there, Ron Nyholm and Jack Lewis and all these guys that I knew, and gave a talk. And afterwards, I met with him in his office. And we had just done what we thought was a very definitive experiment in dimethyl sulfoxide, not in water, and were able to show that this pre-acid-base equilibrium rapid reaction was responsible for the first order dependence on hydroxide. When I told the discussed this, or it was in one or two of my slides in my talk, well, Engel, the first thing he wanted to point out to me was that but Fred, dimethyl sulfoxide is not water, you know, so this doesn't tell us anything about what happens in water. Well, fortunately, Henry Taube was doing this kind of chemistry, and Henry Taube at that time was at Chicago still, and Henry and I would keep in touch. And I knew that Henry Taube had done analogous experiments in water using oxygen 18 labeling, and the results were consistent with what results we had gotten in dimethyl sulfoxide. So I was able to tell Engel about this, and he polished it off. But Engel was notorious for doing this kind of thing. I found out later, among physical organic chemists, that there had been times in physical organic chemistry where he had not been right, but he would never admit in print that he was wrong, and he never did admit in print that he was wrong here. He just simply looked the other way and went on to something else. But Nyholm and Taube and these people were certainly, and Taube has published several papers where he uses the conjugate base mechanism, which is the one that we had proposed.
How did, as you began this work, how did the rest of the inorganic chemists respond to what you were doing? The Solo and Pearson book didn't come out until when?
58.
So there we are. How did the rest of the inorganic chemists respond?
Well, first of all, there weren't that many inorganic chemists in those days. There were some. There were beginning to be more and more, because a lot of people had gone on the Manhattan Project and had become interested in the transition metals and the actinides and lanthanide-type metals and so forth. So there were more and more inorganic chemists, but not all that many. And so our papers were being read, finally. I mean, in the early days when I worked with Baylor and not long after, you publish a paper, you never hear any reprint requests or anything else. But there was a cadre of physical inorganic chemists out there, such as Taube and others who had worked on the Manhattan Project, who really were interested in the solution chemistry, kinetics, and equilibrium mechanisms, and so forth, that were reading our papers. And there were even, I think, the first symposium on the subject of mechanisms of inorganic reactions was held at the University of Chicago, set up by Henry Taube. And I presented a paper there. Later on, we had a symposium here just about, I think it was right at 58, just about the time our book came out. We had a symposium. By that time, we must have had about 60 or 70 people who attended that symposium here on mechanisms. So it all of a sudden took hold. And the book, of course, was a winner from the day it arrived, because it was the first such book, and particularly it was the first such book that not only had mechanisms in it, but likewise had crystal field theory and made use of crystal field theory in trying to rationalize some of the results. So the timing was just absolutely perfect.
How did you pick up crystal field theory?
Well, I'd never even heard of it until I went to Copenhagen in 54-55, a year's leave of absence. And I went there with Professor Yannick Bjerm. Yannick Bjerm is well-known by coordination chemist, did his thesis on measurement of stepwise stability constants of the copper ammonium complexes, and then all of that took off. His father was Niels Bjerm, who was even a more famous, almost got the Nobel Prize. There are stories about why he did it or something. Anyway, when I got there in Yannick Bjerm's lab, he had people, Carl Bellhausen, who's outstanding in theory and crystal field theory. Klingspiel-Jorgensen, likewise, and so forth. Klaus Schaefer, Wolbe. He had four or five people, just young assistants in his lab at that time. And what these people were doing was crystal field theory, which I hadn't even heard of. And what they had that I didn't have was they had Mark I of a Cary spectrophotometer, which was not gray. Black, actually. The first ones they made were black. Later they made them battleship gray. And the reason they had that is, of course, in Copenhagen at that time, Carlsberg family had finally gone down to this one person who hadn't married and didn't have any financial responsibilities and was interested in the arts and sciences. So he set up the foundation here many years ago, Carlsberg Foundation for the Support of Arts and Sciences in Denmark. So as you go around the museums and any place in Denmark, you'll see usually courtesy of Carlsberg Brewery or Carlsberg Foundation. And they had bought themselves the very first Cary spectrophotometer. And there was Klingspiel-Jorgensen down there. He was really a terror in the lab. But anyway, he was taking spectra of all of the aqua transition metals, just all of them practically, and every spectra that he took of these things, it was another paper interpreted in terms of crystal field theory, because valence bond theory, which I grew up on, could not even begin to interpret those spectra. But crystal field theory did it very well, did it very nicely, those people who were capable of doing it that way. And these people certainly handled English quite well, but their written English needed some polishing. So almost every Monday, almost every week, Klingspiel particularly, and Bellhausen, but mostly Klingspiel, would come in with another manuscript, which he would give to me to help him put it in better English. And so I got my exposure to crystal field theory this way. And I immediately let Ralph know, because he's more physical, more mathematical and so forth than I. And he looked into it. And by the time I came back, after that year's leave, he had looked into it sufficiently that he was all excited about it. So the book that was written in part by me while I was on leave of absence. And when I got back, I again had to convince Ralph that he should join me as a co-author and that we should do this. And he was, you know, less than enthusiastic until he read a few of the chapters that I'd written. And then he got excited, and then he saw how he could really fill in the crystal field aspects of all of this and really bring it all together. So he jumped in with both feet and finished up the book. So together we wrote the book. The first book was easy to write because at that time the kind of work that was going on of this type, kinetics and mechanism, either we were doing it or Taube or a few other labs, and we knew exactly what everybody was doing and what the status of it was and so forth. So you didn't have to conduct much of a literature survey. You pretty much knew everything that needed to be known. So we could sit down and write the book as we did without all that much effort. Later, of course, in 67, when we revised it, it was much more of an effort because by that time the whole field had grown by leaps and bounds, and then you had to be selective of what examples you would use to illustrate whatever principle you wanted to illustrate. And subsequent to that, even now, people are still banging on our door wanting us to revise it one more time because it's gone out of print. And in most countries, in many countries, they still hustle up enough copies to use it. They prefer to use it to some of the more recent books that have been written on the subject. And I can understand it because it covers the area in sufficient detail. And a more comprehensive coverage. The ones that are written now are written by somebody whose interest is specifically bioinorganic chemistry or specifically homogeneous catalysis or specifically something else. So this is still being used, although it's out of print everything.
Did you have a commitment from the publisher before you started?
No, it was not written with any intent of making money or that it would make money. And it sold like hotcakes, and it did make money, but not huge sums of money, because it was never written as a textbook even, although it was used at the graduate level as a book by many people. Although I give a course in coordination chemistry, and I've never really required it that it be used, although I put it on reserve in the library and tell people that the book exists, and some of them take advantage of having a look at it.
You mentioned that it was easy the first time because most of the work was being done by you and Taube and others. Was there any work going on outside of Europe? I mean, in Europe, or was it mostly in this country?
Mostly in the U.S., I think. In fact, I have a story that I always tell when I give this talk on carbon monoxide substitution in metal carbonyls and substituted metal carbonyls, how we got into that. When I was in Copenhagen, 54-55, in May, Mary and I, my wife, left the two kids with the babysitter and people in the neighborhood there that we'd gotten to know by then. And we took off. We'd never been to Europe on the continent before. And so the first stop was in Amsterdam, one of the first stops, where I attended an international conference on coordination chemistry. And one of the plenary lectures was given by the late Walter Heber. Walter Heber did not discover metal carbonyls, but he's really known as the father of metal carbonyl chemistry, because Mond, who did discover metal carbonyls, was in industry, and he never published too much about it. You know, he didn't continue the work. He certainly did discover it and did patent, I guess, the discovery and whatever. But Walter Heber had an institute at the Technical University of Munich, with never less than 40 or 50 people working, and they were all working on metal carbonyl chemistry, synthesis reactions, and so forth for umpteen years. He was a bachelor. He was just wed to metal carbonyl chemistry. So in this plenary lecture, he had slide after slide after slide that he showed on the work that they had done. And when it was all over with, he had given this in German because his couldn't handle English, didn't know English. But you could tell from the slides that he had what was done. And when it was all over with, I complimented him in English. Of course, I don't know any German. And said, gee, this is all very nice. Can you tell us a little bit about how some of these reactions take place? And through an interpreter, he looked at me. He said, young man, you know, 55, I was a lot younger. He said, young man, in my institute, we do real chemistry. We don't do the philosophy of chemistry. So what he really said was, we're interested in reactions and synthesis, and we don't give a damn about theories of bonding or this, that, or the other, and mechanisms.